Please, thank you.
May it please the court, James D. Smith, Solicitor General for the State of Nebraska, and with the assistance of opposing counsel, she has clarified for me that I represent the appellant.
And for the record, the court has indicated 20 minutes. Is that what everybody understands?
That's what I understand, and I told the bailiff earlier I wanted 5 for a rebuttal.
So. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
The district court in this case erred by ordering a new trial and by not sustaining the state's motion for reconsideration for 4 reasons. The first reason, which I think is dispositive, is that the district court ordered a new trial without the most basic necessary ingredient for granting a new trial for newly discovered evidence, and that is evidence. No evidence was presented by Harris. No evidence was received by the district court at any hearing on Harris's motion for a new trial. Second reason...
How did the court get to where it got without evidence? Was there some reference back to earlier hearings or judicial notice of a bill of exceptions? How did it get there?
I guess what I would say is how the court got there was by making a wrong turn and doing it wrong. The bill of exceptions for the hearing on the motion for new trial, there is just no offer of evidence. There is no reception of evidence. There is opposing counsel saying that when they're talking about this post-conviction motion, announcing some intention to offer a prior record, but that's in the context of the post-conviction motion. No evidence on that was even offered at the hearing. So. The record itself just shows there was no evidence offered, no opportunity to object, no reception of evidence. So I guess the bottom line is that's the fundamental problem with how the judge got there, is the judge got there by doing it wrong.
Did the judge rely on the affidavits that were attached to the motion for new trial? Can you tell from the order?
Well, you can't tell because the judge simply starts talking about the judge's order kind of talks about things that were referenced in the attached affidavits, but the law is very clear for those to be considered. Those affidavits themselves have to be offered, they have to be received. That just plain never happened. Now, the second motion, or second reason why the case should be reversed is the judge's, or the state's motion for reconsideration of Judge Zastera's new trial order was not moot. Judge Nelson found that it was moot, but the defendant's speedy trial motion necessarily depended upon you had a valid order for a new trial. If the order for a new trial was erroneously entered, then there's no basis to grant a speedy trial motion when there's no valid order for a new trial. So,
what was the state's position at the hearing in front of Judge Nelson on that very issue?
Basically what the state's position was that it was arguing, and what it's in its motion for reconsideration, the very thing I said in the first point was there wasn't any evidence that supported the granting of the new trial.
I mean, on the question of mootness, what was the state's position?
Well, the state's position, I think, was just submitting it all to the judge. I think counsel for the state said initially when the judge is trying to decide what order it's going to take all of these motions up, that the state did make the comment, I don't know, but I think it's probably moot. I don't think that constitutes an agreement that it was moot. It just says, I don't know, probably moot, but I don't know, I don't think is a position other than I don't know.
Before we can get to the merits of your arguments on whether the motion for new trial should have been granted, I think we have to satisfy ourselves that we have jurisdiction to reach it. So what's the state's strongest argument that this is something we can review?
What I put in the brief was two pathways to get there. One was relying upon State v. Thalkin as to what the court meant by State v. Thalkin would be one pathway. The other pathway would be by a prosecutor's error appeal, which we also did file and I believe was perfected. So it's either under the prosecutor error appeal, it's under filing a notice of appeal from a final order in a special proceeding as a collateral attack. The state timely filed notice of appeal, paid the docket filing fee. So essentially the state went with two pathways to get here, but I think at least under the prosecutor error appeal is valid. I guess under the State v. Thalkin theory, it would depend somewhat on what the court meant by some of the language in that case, which indicated there are other statutes that allow a prosecutor to file an appeal. Those statutes that I would cite would be 24-204, 25-1911, and 25-13-1503, all of which to me would give the state the right to file an appeal, which the state did in this case. And then per Thalkin 25-19-12 then describes the procedure for the appeal, which the state did follow and perfect the appeal. I know there would be an issue, and it's addressed in our reply brief, as to whether the state can appeal from an order for new trial. My reply brief explains why the three cases, State v. Taylor, State v. Lynn, State v. Martinez, to me, all of those cases are distinguishable because those cases, unlike Harris, don't involve the state appealing from a collateral attack special proceeding that it had overturned the state's substantial right in a prior final judgment. In other words, we have a final judgment that was years ago, unlike the Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez cases, and it's then obviously a collateral attack. It's becoming a special proceeding that the state then would have the right to appeal. I don't think Taylor, Lynn, or Martinez factually involve this type of a situation.
If there's jurisdiction for the state to be the appellant, and the exception/error path,
sure.
What rulings are you objecting to?
We're objecting to the court's order granting a new trial, and also for the court not sustaining the motion for reconsideration by declaring that that motion was moot. The order on the new trial that had been told in its finality by the motion for reconsideration, and so that necessarily meant the order for new trial was told until the court ruled on the motion for reconsideration. We're also appealing from the speedy trial order, both of the speedy trial order and the order saying not sustaining the motions for reconsideration. Both of those orders were entered on the same day.
If you're proceeding under the prosecutor error proceeding statute, what's your position with respect to whether the orders you're challenging were entered after the defendant was placed in jeopardy?
Well, as far as him after he's being placed in jeopardy, once the judge enters an order saying you get a new trial, there's no longer any jeopardy, just disappeared, would be the state's position. There's no jeopardy there if you're going to have a new trial.
Is that because it's the language of new trial? It's not, let's say, a reversal.
Well, if you're getting a new trial, you necessarily haven't had jurisdiction jeopardy attached.
But some reversals in favor of defendants result in double jeopardy.
That would be true, but not a new trial.
Not, and your position is not where a new trial would be indicated.
I'm
not sure if it's circular, but that is your position.
That is the position, because if you've got a new trial, you haven't had jeopardy attached in which you're claiming a right to the old trial. The old trial was he got convicted. the new trial had never
so
been.
So everybody agrees at some point he was in jeopardy with respect to the initial conviction and so forth.
Well, right. When he initially got convicted,
right.
He was in jeopardy. He's the one who asked for the
right.
new trial. He got the new trial, so therefore he can't claim that jeopardy has attached because I got what I wanted, which was a new trial.
Thank you.
So if we would agree with your first argument that the new trial should not have been granted because there was no evidence offered or received, what's the relief you would suggest?
Well, the relief that we suggested, at least in the conclusion of our brief, is to remand the case back to the district court to do what it should have done, never did after Harris 4 and after 5, which was decide the third amended motion for post-conviction relief, which is what this court directed the district court to do twice, and it didn't do, and thus that would be a third reason we had as to why the district court erred. It didn't have any authority or power to consider that motion for new trial in view of the mandates that had come down in Harris 4 and Harris 5. The district court simply ignored what this court ordered the district court to do after Harris 4 and after Harris 5, which is why we keep having these, I guess, motions being filed contrary to what the district court should have been considering. There's one more thing I would like to respond to, Judge Moore. We also have said that as far as the motion for new trial on its face, it doesn't have any merit because the grounds for the newly discovered evidence is impeachment of the state's witness, Harris. There were three other witnesses who testified at the trial concerning the defendant's admissions that he went and shot and killed the victim. That motion for new trial doesn't impeach, have anything to do with those other three witnesses. It's simply trying to impeach Homicide Hicks.
I know this is not consistent with what you're
sure.
advocating, but if the trial court had been correct in ordering a new trial, how would the clock start running on the discharge?
So you're going into the speedy trial argument. Okay. The clock, the arguments we made on the speedy trial claim is, one, the speedy trial clock never started because it doesn't run under the statute until you have the mandate from the appellate court. The state had filed an appeal. It filed a motion for reconsideration. There was an issue whether the motion for reconsideration was a motion to alter or amend.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but then that was the 17 case that went up on appeal, but... Right.
That would be the case, it
that
went up on appeal.
That was dismissed because reconsideration was still hanging out there.
It was hanging out there, and the court's dismissal and its show cause order reflected that the motion for reconsideration was being viewed by this court as a motion to alter or amend, which told the appeal time. The court then dismissed the appeal. The mandate that was issued by this court was not acted on by the district court until after the appellant had filed a motion for speedy trial discharge. So since the clock doesn't start to run until the district court acts on the mandate and the motion for speedy trial discharge had already been filed, the defense motion, the speedy trial clock never started to run until the district court ruled on the speedy trial discharge, which is, that's one of our arguments we make is the speedy trial clock never started because of the appeal, the mandate, when the district court acted on the mandate, and then the defendant filed a premature motions for speedy trial discharge, which then that also tolls the running of the speedy trial or of the speedy trial discharge until the district court ruled on that motion for a speedy trial discharge, which would be the final disposition of that defense motion. Our final speedy trial argument would be good cause. I think this is obviously quite a convoluted, unique case, and the state and from the affidavit that was offered at the hearing on the motion for speedy trial, which is another assignment of error, speedy trial discharge, the affidavit would have explained that what the state did in filing that appeal that was later dismissed was because of the uncertainty and the concern of the state's trying to preserve his ability to charge or challenge that speedy trial or that order for motion for new trial. Because of the state wanting to be able to charge that, what it did was file a motion for reconsideration. Judge Zastera's then gone. We don't have a judge to rule on it. And so the state then files the appeal to at least try to protect its right to challenge the order for new trial. And our argument is that falls into the good cause category.
Can I, let me back up yet again on this underlying new trial. If this court were to conclude that the granting of the new trial was erroneous, then finish the sentence, clock never started. Is that your position?
Yes, because the order for new trial is just plain wrong, so there's no speedy trial motion to attach to.
What should the district court have done after Harris 5?
It should have done what the court told it to do, which was to review the or clarify whether it was acting on the second or third amended post-conviction motion, and then apply the correct legal standard in deciding that motion on the merits. The district court simply didn't do that in this case again.
How did it rule on the third post-conviction motion? Is there a ruling?
What its ruling was that the district court's order erroneously says that it first must consider whether the defendant's entitled to a new trial, which is wrong under the mandates in Harris 4 and 5. But that's what the judge did, was then decide the motion for new trial, which was filed after the Harris 5 mandate, and then the district court grants the order for new trial based on a constitutional standard, which was again wrong, and then once it grants the motion for new trial, then it just dismissed the third amended post-conviction because apparently it decided there was nothing left for the court to do.
It dismissed it without prejudice. What does that mean?
With Judge Zastera, I guess that would mean, without prejudice, would mean you could somehow refile it. I guess the state's position is the defendant never should have got an order for a new trial on newly discovered evidence without presenting any evidence whatsoever to justify the court's order. That being true, this case should be reversed, remanded, speedy trial set aside, the order for new trial, or speedy trial discharge set aside, order for new trial set aside, and the case should be remanded with directions to the district court to do what it actually had been ordered to do but failed to do in Harris 4 and Harris 5, and that's make a decision on the merits on the amended post-conviction motion in which there had been an evidentiary hearing years ago, and apply the correct legal standard when deciding the post-conviction motion.
Before you sit down, is it the state's position that 29-2101, the motion for new trial statute, is a criminal proceeding in certain contexts, but a special proceeding when applied in different contexts?
In a collateral attack proceeding, yes.
How do we know when it's collateral and when it's ongoing criminal case?
I guess it would be a collateral attack when you have a final judgment, as opposed to just a motion for new trial when you don't have a final judgment. But it's a final judgment in this case. It's a collateral attack simply by the fact he's attacking a final judgment from 15 years ago. That's different than asking for a motion for new trial when you haven't even been sentenced yet.
But you could have a newly discovered evidence new trial motion that's not a collateral attack, then. It doesn't depend on which prong of 29-2101 you're going under. Your argument is whether it's collateral or not depends on the finality of the judgment.
I think for a special proceeding, it does depend upon the finality. If you're going under attempting to appeal when you haven't had a final judgment yet, then there's an issue whether you could even appeal something that's not a final judgment per the court's prior cases. You can't appeal a motion for new trial if it's not a final judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Sarah Newell. I'm an attorney for the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy. I represent Jack Harris, the appellee in this matter, and the appellant on cross appeal. I apologize, I have a cold. I hope that I'm far enough back that I will not affect you. I want to start by noting that we submit to this court that the easiest way to resolve this matter is to simply affirm Judge Nelson's ruling with regard to the speedy trial. And I would submit to you that that is the only issue before you properly, because the motion to the state's effort to appeal the order granting the new trial is too late, and for a variety of reasons, they've waived the opportunity to raise that issue. Quite frankly, because the state botched the initial appeal. This court has numerous cases that make it clear that you cannot extend the time for which to appeal by pursuing successive appeals or by renaming things in a creative manner. A lot of those cases have come out in the past number of months. I'll get to those in a second.
How did the state botch the appeal?
So to the extent that the order granting the new trial is a final appealable order, setting aside Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez, and other questions about whether it is, in fact, a substantial right within a special proceeding. That aside, if it was appealable, then the state should have appealed it properly within the first 30 days. An appeal was filed here, but the way that the state filed it, they filed the motion to reconsider first, did not set it for hearing despite local district court rules requiring that a hearing be set, did not litigate the hearing, and did not obtain any kind of ruling from the district court before filing its notice for appeal. The statutes and the case law are 100% clear that you do not have a final order when a motion to reconsider is still pending. So filing the notice of appeal when the motion to reconsider had not been ruled on, by definition, renders it a non-final order, which is why Judge Nelson properly determined that the speedy trial clock had not been told in any way by the state's appeal, by the state's initial appeal, because the state's appeal of a non-final order was not statutorily authorized under Hood or Recheck. So what the state did was file this appeal and did it in a way that guaranteed that the proceedings would be prolonged for at least a year, or for at least as long as the appeal took, and did not make any effort, like I said, to set that for hearing or to obtain a ruling. The real problem, or the other thing that sets this case aside from the fact that the state just quite frankly botched it by not obtaining a ruling on a motion to reconsider or asking for a new judge to obtain a ruling on the motion
when
to reconsider.
When you say botched, is the point, pardon me, that appeal was dismissed? In other words, the outcome of that appeal, or are you saying that the path to the appeal, I'm going to say, was fanciful, not authorized?
The path to the appeal is not statutorily authorized. It's explicitly not authorized by statute and by State v. Jibalisco, which, interestingly, the Attorney General's office conceded when this court issued its order to show cause. When that case went up on appeal, this court said, hey, why is this a final order? You have 10 days to tell us why this is a final order. Not only did the state not respond to that, but later on when the state's brief came due, the state filed a motion asking for extension of brief date, saying, well, we didn't respond to the order to show cause because we quite frankly agreed that there's no way that we could show cause, because it was clear to them on the face of the statute and on the face of State v. Jibalisco that is a non-final order. If there's no ruling on the motion to reconsider, then that time for appeal is terminated and it is just permanently held in limbo. And there's nothing about that effort that divests the jurisdiction or would in any way stop the speedy trial clock.
If the state appealed too early because there is a pending motion to alter or amend, doesn't jurisdiction remain in the trial court? And then once the appeal is dismissed, jurisdiction's been there all along, and that motion to alter or amend is sitting there waiting to be decided. Judge Nelson decides it, and now the state's appealing. What's problematic about that?
That is the way that the Judge Nelson analyzed the case. What is problematic about that is that the way that the state has gone, well, one, Judge Nelson determined that ruling was moot because there was nothing that told the speedy trial clock, and if the speedy trial clock has run, then Mr. Harris is absolutely discharged and the state has missed its window in terms of challenging the order for new trial. The other issue with that is, as Judge Stacy had indicated earlier, the state has essentially waived its opportunity to challenge, or basically waived its opportunity to assert the argument that Mr. Smith is making today. Because in that motion for speedy trial, we had the motion for reconsideration, the motion for absolute discharge, and a motion to dismiss the motion of reconsideration. When those issues were being taken up, Judge Nelson says, well, I'm inclined to start with the motion to reconsider. Mr. O'Brien, the state's representative, said, Judge, I think we should take up the motion for speedy trial first, because depending on how you rule on the motion for speedy trial, then my motion to reconsider is mooted.
Probably
mooted. Realistically, under no circumstance other than this case would an argument that using the word probably in that context seem legitimate. If I were to make that argument, the argument would be you invited the error. You don't get to say, hey, Judge, let's do it a certain way, and then turn around and after it bites you in the butt, say, you know, I didn't really mean it. I'm not saying he's conceding that it was moot. What I'm saying is the state's argument now is that somehow the order granting the new trial was so invalid that it somehow undermines and stops the speedy trial clock from even starting. There's nothing in the speedy trial clock or speedy trial statutes that say that the speedy trial clock starts any time other than when an order for new trial is granted. There's nothing that says when a valid order for new trial is granted. The state is arguing here that the order granting the new trial is invalid and that somehow divests the court of subject matter jurisdiction because it needs to, because otherwise there's no way to get to this issue, because they should have brought this up within the 30 days within the initial appeal. When they had no ruling on the motion to reconsider, they should have either dismissed it or they should have said, Chief Justice Hevigan, appoint a new judge so that we can litigate this and get it resolved within the appellate time. The proper time to raise that issue was back then. It is the idea that you can then extend the time for appeal for essentially 2 years is part of the problem here. As recently as, I think in the last couple weeks, this court came down with, I'm trying to find a specific case. In Green v. Seifert, this court addressed a similar, not obviously nothing is similar to this case. This case is a special branch of hell. Mr. Smith and I can agree on that. But in Seifert, this court basically looked at these same kind of issues and said that you can't extend the time you can't extend the time for appeal and get creative with these kind of deadlines by being creative in the way that you're naming the appeal. You can't say, well, we're not appealing the original thing that was denied, we're appealing the motion to reconsider, the denial of the motion to reconsider. There comes a point where you got to do it right the first time, and quite frankly, the state just didn't do that.
Green versus Seifert, there was no motion to alter amend. It was outside of the...
The reason I brought up Green versus Seifert is because in that case, the court determined that a failure to hold a hearing did not deny subject matter jurisdiction. And that's kind of what the state is wanting to say here, is the fact that Judge Zastera did not hold a hearing in the traditional sense then means that undermines the entire speedy trial argument and the speedy trial clock is stopped. The speedy trial statutes say that if a defendant is to be tried again following an order for a new trial, then the period shall commence to run from the date of the order granting a new trial. The state presents no statutory authority for why that is not the case. Judge Nelson's analysis on the speedy trial
determination is correct. But the state's argument, is it not addressed to that, is that it was new trial order was incorrect.
But the statute says nothing about whether the order for a new trial is valid. And I submit to you that part of the reason, if I may, part of the reason why this statute just says an order for a new trial and does not say, presume that it's valid, is because under the logic behind Taylor and Martinez, in a criminal matter, an order for a new trial is not appealable. If you look at post-conviction statutes, the post-conviction statutes specifically say that an order is appealable whether it comes from the defendant or the state. It doesn't use that specific language, but it talks about whether it's overruled or whether it's upheld. In a motion for new trial, there is no grant of there's no grant of an appellate right. This court has determined that there is a right for a defendant to appeal a motion for new trial based on DNA evidence under the logic of the collateral attack, which is what the state seeks to expand here. But I would submit to you that even if you don't want to follow Taylor Lynn and Martinez, that looking at whether or not this is a special proceeding, it is not a substantial right. And I would say that for two reasons. One, if you look at the new trial statutes, the ones applicable here, 2921.01, the first sentence says, a new trial after verdict of conviction may be granted on the application of the defendant for any of the following grounds affecting materially his or her substantial rights. The following provision, 2921.02, also talks about things that would materially affect the substantial rights of the defendant. I think that this is relevant, one, because the substantial right is a term of art. The defendant has the right to appeal a denial of a order for new trial, but there's nothing in these provisions that talk about a substantial right, vesting a substantial right with the state. And I would submit that that is for all the reasons that are addressed in Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez. And then also, if you look at Professor Lenich's What's So Special About Special Proceedings, the Law Review article that tries to unpack some of this. Obviously, as you're painfully aware, what is a final order and what constitutes a special proceeding and what constitutes an action is very complicated, particularly in this criminal context. What I would submit to you is that even if this is a special proceeding, that the state has no substantial right for the various reasons that come into play in Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez, and also because if you look at the logic, so Lenich argues that finality should be the underlying policy behind what constitutes a substantial right. And he looks at, you want to allow an appellate court to avoid deciding issues that may be mooted by subsequent developments in the litigation. In this kind of case, if Mr. Harris wins, then the state's argument is mooted. I would liken it to a plea and abatement. In a criminal case, in a plea and abatement, a defendant, if you win the plea and abatement, the case goes away, or at least temporarily. If you lose a plea and abatement, this court has said that that is not a final appealable order until the end of the case, and that any kind of error in not agreeing with the defendant on the plea and abatement is then essentially mooted, because by the time, if you get convicted at trial, then you already lost at a higher standard, so what does it matter? It's the same kind of situation here. If Mr. Harris is acquitted at trial, then it doesn't matter whether the new trial was appropriately granted. Other factors to consider are that this allows the, or finding this to not be a final appealable order allows the trial court to move forward on a case instead of putting it on hold for a year during interlocutory appeal. This case has been pending for 2 years because the state didn't properly appeal the initial order, because it did not get a ruling, insist on a ruling, the motion to reconsider before it proceeded with filing the appeal. It also prevents one party from using the appellate procedure to wear down a financially weaker adversary by filing dilatory appeals. In this situation, Mr. Harris is in custody. He's been in custody this entire time. If Judge Nelson is correct and he should have been absolutely discharged, the time that he has been remaining in custody has been prolonged because the state, quite frankly, couldn't bother to file the notice of appeal properly and obtain a ruling on the motion to reconsider back when the issue was before it.
But isn't it your position that they never could have appealed? Even if they'd done it right, they couldn't have appealed.
I would submit to you that that is the way that makes the most sense and that is the most consistent with the statutes. And I would say that because, again, if you look at the speedy trial statutes, it talks about an order for a new trial, order granting a new trial. It does not say anything about the state appealing a new trial. Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez have been the law for a consistent amount of time. And the motion for new trial statutes, I think, are distinct from the post-conviction statutes. The fact that the state specifically has a right to appeal explicitly expressed in post-conviction but not in the motion for new trial makes sense. The other thing about the speedy trial statute that supports the idea of finding this not to be a final order appealable substantial right is that if you look at the speedy trial statutes, under 4, the things that the state is trying to rely on saying proceedings concerning the defendant, all of the proceedings concerning the defendant occur after a new trial has been granted. All of these talk about pretrial motions. The difficulty in analyzing it, I think Judge Miller-Lerman asked this, if the state had properly appealed this initially, how do you apply the speedy trial statutes? I mean, there's nothing in here that says that the time is told or that, I mean, there's nothing staying the order while that appeal is pending. This talks about things that happen, delays that the defendant causes after the trial has begun or after the trial has been granted. Talking about pretrial motions. What the state wants to say here is that Mr. Harris's motion for a new trial somehow is a motion that stops the speedy trial clock. It can't stop the speedy trial clock because the granting of that motion is what starts the speedy trial clock. And this court has said, I believe, and I put it in my brief, and I don't know that I have the case in front of me, but this court has said that the things that happen before the information is filed, before the event triggering the speedy trial clock has begun, can't be taken into consideration. The case I'm specifically thinking of, I know I said it in my brief, I can't remember the name offhand, but it was a case that dealt with a plea agreement that had been reached, and then some things had been dismissed, and then they refiled, and the court said, well, we're not going to take into consideration any time that towards the speedy trial clock that happened before the information was filed. And again, the information being filed is the triggering event, the thing that starts the speedy trial clock. So how can you realistically do a speedy trial analysis if you're counting against the defendant things that happened before the triggering event even occurred?
I'd like to shift gears just a little bit to be sure I understand your argument. Assume that you have a conviction years ago. No, there may have been direct appeals, that's been resolved, but you have no post-conviction at all. And you then have defendant files a motion for a new trial based on new evidence. Mm-hmm. And that motion is granted and a new trial is ordered. That fact scenario, are we then, is it your position that the state has no opportunity to appeal from that determination that in effect sets aside the long ago final judgment?
I would argue that in my opinion, the cleanest way to resolve that issue is to say that no, you cannot appeal it. But I will also tell you that it doesn't, for the purposes of this analysis, it doesn't matter. Even if you say that that Judge Nelson was correct, that the order granting a new trial is a final appealable order, that does not change the fact that Mr. Harris's speedy trial rights have been violated here. Because the state's initial appeal did not toll the time in any way because it was not statutorily authorized. Because under State v. Jibalisco and under the basic, I think it's 19, I can't remember the statute offhand, but the basic appellate rules, a motion for reconsideration terminates the time for appeal. So in that situation, analyzing it the way that you wanted to, Justice Papik, how do I say this more clearly? Just as Judge Nelson analyzed, it is not a foreseeable consequence for the defendant, for Mr. Harris, to foresee that the state was going to botch the initial appeal by not setting the motion for reconsideration for hearing and then filing a notice of appeal. There is no question, there's no novel law regarding that issue. That is 100% dead set clear. So much so that the Attorney General's office conceded it in the response to order to show cause. We didn't respond because we didn't think that there was jurisdiction. They agreed that there is no jurisdiction. So in that kind of a situation, that is not a statutorily authorized appeal under Hood, and it is not something that divests jurisdiction. There was the mandate, all this talk about the mandate, none of that matters because jurisdiction was never divested because it was never proper in the first place.
So to return to my question, I'm not sure that I ultimately got a direct answer to the question. The ultimate answer was it doesn't matter, but I'm still interested in your view of the question that I asked, which is in that circumstance where you have a long ago final judgment, a motion for new trial based upon newly discovered evidence, a grant of a motion for new trial, appeal by the state or no?
I don't have a clear answer for you because I don't think that it's clear what the answer should be. What I would say is that under Taylor, Lynn, and Martinez, the answer is no. But as Judge Nelson determined, there is a decent argument that a collateral attack should be treated differently. We obviously have treated it differently, or I guess this court, I'm not, we, this is not involved in, this court has decided that in terms of a DNA, motion for new trial under DNA statute, said it is a collateral attack. I would submit that there are arguments for why that should not be the case in this context, but like I said, realistically, if you want to determine that it's a collateral attack and that it is appealable, then that's fine. The state should have appealed it back then. What happened here, what they did wrong, was not obtaining a hearing and not obtaining a ruling on the motion to reconsider before filing the appeal. And that's just appellate law 101.
If this is a special proceeding, does it become civil in nature? And is the state correct that under the civil statutes, 25.13.15.03 makes this a statutorily authorized right to appeal?
I see that I'm out of time. May I answer?
Yes.
As I read, I think that's a tough question. I don't have a clear answer. As I read Professor Lenich's article, I think that this is a very messy area of the law. I don't think it needs to be civil. I think that you can say that it's a special proceeding and it doesn't matter if it's civil or not. I mean, there's all kinds of case law that talks about civil, I mean, I cited it in my brief, talking about a special proceeding is civil in nature. Again, I don't know that I think it really matters, aside from the fact that we have clear case law that says that motions for new trial in a criminal context are not final appealable orders. Within the criminal context, there's also the problem, and I think this problem exists here as well. And one of the cases, and I'll come back to that. The issue that exists here is when ordering or granting an order for a new trial, you're sort of implicitly, if not explicitly, vacating the prior conviction. So when a prior conviction has been vacated, it's not clear how that works in terms of what authority the court or anyone has to reinstate it without there being some kind of jeopardy issue, without there being bigger problems that, quite frankly, I have not foreseen. That's part of why I argue to this court that it's cleaner and easier, if you decide to reach the issue, to say that there's not a substantial right vested in the state because the statutes do not talk about a substantial right for the state. Again, none of that matters for the purposes of Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris should be walking free based on Judge Nelson's analysis. If I were you, I would duck the issue. I would say that this is not properly before the court and we should wait until something with a more clear case is presented. If you want to go there, mazel tov, but I don't think you need to. I see that about
time. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we went a little bit over there with Ms. Newley. Want to give Mr. Smith another minute.
Okay.
Thank you. I heard a new term, which was Judge Zastera did not hold a hearing in the traditional sense, and I would agree with that. I think that's also known as reversible error for granting a new trial on a motion based upon newly discovered evidence without receiving in evidence any of the newly discovered evidence. As far as the state's substantial right, the state obviously has a substantial right in a 17-year-old final murder conviction. And if opposing counsel was correct, I think it would be just astounding that the state, having a substantial right in a final, long ago final murder conviction, would never be able to appeal a decision in which the judge erroneously reversed
and
granted.
Well, I think that's everybody's nibbling at when the state can appeal. So
yeah.
You want to speak to that going back to jurisdiction? Is that too old school?
I'll give the court three statutes, various pathways is in the brief. Sections 24204, 251911, 25.13.15.03, 29-2315.01, which is the prosecutor error appeal. I would say that those statutes are all give the state the right to appeal. If the court disagrees, at least some of those statutes, clearly the prosecutor error appeal should give the state the right to appeal from Judge Zastera's erroneous new trial order. With that, unless the court has additional questions, we would ask the judge or the trial court's orders be reversed and that the trial court be remanded with directions to do what it was supposed to do after Harris 4 and Harris 5.
Thank you. You're excused. We're adjourned.
Right side for that.